You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. You know, I was just listening to a great piece of reporting. I was telling Ollie about it on This American Life, about the remote town of Homer, Alaska, that has no undocumented immigrants. But even the possibility of them arriving, however remote, put the whole town at each other's throats. It was quite an amazing piece of reporting. And as Ollie Nirani writes in his new book, "Elections Matter, But Culture Matters More." And in There Goes the Neighborhood, How Communities Overcome Prejudice and Meet the Challenge of American Immigration, Ollie Nirani unpacks America's complicated, conflicted views of immigration. The book is the product of months of traveling across the country from apple farms in Washington State to the White House in D.C., and offers Nirani's approach, which we'll hear about tonight, towards bringing Americans together around this contentious issue. He follows the personal stories of Americans from across the political spectrum, including conservative faith, business, and law enforcement leaders who are all grappling with the question, do we as Americans value immigrants and immigration anymore? As the daughter of an immigrant, that's a very vital question, and I sure hope we do, because I do. Ali Nirani is the executive director of the National Immigration Forum, an advocacy organization promoting the value of immigrants and immigration. He grew up in California as the son of Pakistani immigrants, and he learned then how to forge alliances among people of wide-ranging backgrounds. And it's a skill that has served him well as one of the nation's most innovative coalition builders. In 2015, Ali was named a lifetime member of the Council on Foreign Relations. And exploring how immigration is affecting the changing nature of American identity, he will be talking tonight with Pilar Marrero, a journalist with long experience in covering social and political issues in the Latino community in the United States. Ms. Marrero is the author of Killing the American Dream, a chronicle of U.S. immigration policy mishaps, and she's currently covering the impact of our president's policies on the immigrant community for Impromedia, a company with media outlets in 15 markets across the U.S., including the flagship La Opinion newspaper in Los Angeles. So our format tonight is a conversation followed by Q&A from you. We ask that your questions are questions. It's always very appreciated. Maybe ask one question instead of two or three. That will help us answer more of your questions. And then we will be adjourning to the lobby where Mr. Nirani will be signing his books courtesy of our library store. And he does have to leave at 8:45 tonight, so we'll try to get to that in a timely manner. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Ali Nirani and Pilar Marrero to the stage of the library. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. Oh, I already have water here. Hello. How are you all? Thank you for coming. Thank you so much to the Library Foundation and Aloud for having this forum here today about an issue that is so crucial, so critical for our country, and for having me be part of it. Immigration is a fascinating subject for me, because not just because I'm an immigrant, but also because I think nothing exemplifies better the promise of this country, and at the same time, some of the most difficult cultural questions and conflicts that we're having. And that's where we are right now. Ali calls it America's identity crisis. He has written a very provocative book. I think it's a very different take on how to move the conversation forward on immigration. It may not be what you expect from an advocate for immigration. And so let's find out what his book is about. Welcome, Ali. Welcome to LA.
You. Thank you very much for having me. Thank you. Thank you.
It's so good to see you. I see you a lot and talk to you a lot, because as a journalist who covers immigration, I talk to all different advocates and people on the subject. But before we talk about this America's identity crisis mm-hmm. that you talk about in your book, I wanted to refer to the elephant in the room first, and that's not you. is the man that we elected in November. Mm-hmm. So last November, this country elected a president whose campaign was punctuated by this chant, build a wall, and have Mexico pay for it. So there's a lot of cultural anxiety mm-hmm. in that chant. And as a journalist, I saw that cultural anxiety up front when I was covering the campaign. Knowing what you know, Ali, did you expect this wave of nationalist mm-hmm. Feelings to come up and to result in his election?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you very much for joining us this evening. And I really want to thank the Library Foundation and the Allowed Lecture Series for hosting us. It's just it's a real honor and a real privilege to be on this stage. Some incredible people have sat here, and that's it's just incredible. I'm incredibly honored to be here, so thank you. Yes, I expected this. I was not surprised. I can't say that over the course of 2016, I was one of four people in the United States who said Donald Trump is going to win. But every time somebody would ask me, what do you think? I would say, I'm worried. I'm terrified. Because over the last, I think, 5 or 6 years, or even 8 years, quite frankly, we've seen a level of anger at government, mistrust in government, economic anxiety course through the nation. And it's just too easy for people to blame the other. And in this case, the other is the immigrant. It's a natural progression to go from mistrust, anger, anxiety, economic struggle to, okay, I'm going to blame somebody, and I'm going to blame somebody who doesn't look or sound like me. Candidate Trump and now President Trump has tapped into that fear and that anxiety in a remarkable way.
So what is this anxiety? Is it cultural? Is it economic? Is mm-hmm. it racial? Different people, depending on where they are politically, qualify yeah. differently? What is your conclusion?
So as I was writing the book last summer, the timeline of writing the book was that I wrote the first chapter in December of 2015 to kind of like get my head around what the idea was. And then I did the interviews over the course of February, March, and April, and did about 60 interviews with faith, law enforcement, and business leaders across the country. And then I did all the writing pretty much over the course of the summer. So this was just as at the moment in time when the race was crystallizing. And you saw the first round of research and kind of journalism on, who is Donald Trump and what does he mean to the electorate. And there was a particular analysis of the Gallup survey that I wrote about and still sticks with me. And the Gallup survey is, 95,000 voters a week, so it's a massive sample. And they found that the Trump voter made their decision because, number one, they lived in a culturally isolated community, and number two, in some ways more important, is that they wanted their kids to do better than them. And they found that, Donald Trump was the person who could address that that cultural anxiety, but also convey a message so that this voter felt like their kid was going to do better than them. So I think that immigration has always been this conflation of race and class. And I think over the last 2 or 3 years, we've seen an infusion of a national security or public safety element component to it that I don't think we've seen in the past.
So as an advocate, you're a little bit of a strange bird.
Or just as a person.
In general. because you don't go around telling conservatives that they're wrong mm-hmm. on immigration, which is what a lot of advocates do. And in my opinion, sometimes they're right. But in your opinion, what you need to be doing and what you're doing is to go out there and talk to those conservatives and get them on your side and get mm-hmm. them as allies in this sort of conflict around immigration. Tell us why you do that.
That's not the question I was expecting at the end of that. why do I do that? The immigration debate, I think, has always broken down so that, you have a spectrum of 100 people. You've got 20 people who are dead set for immigration reform. You have 20 people who are dead set against anything. And then you have 60 people in the middle. And myself as an individual, us as an organization, the National Immigration Forum, we're focused on those 60 people. And why do I do that? That is the first time I've been asked that question. I'm still
growing.
I do it because I like talking to people. I like to understand what is their fear, what's their anxiety, but more importantly, what can I learn from that person that helps me understand why they believe what they believe? And over the course of this work, just on immigration, I've gotten to know and become friends with people who are culturally and politically much more conservative than I am. And we're not going to agree on questions of, marriage and choice and taxes and all of these things. But because I've sat down and, as an organization, we've sat down and listened and developed a level of trust, I've come to respect their opinion. And if there's anything that I've learned from this journey is that we could use a little bit more respect of opinions in order to change somebody's opinion.
I think that's very relevant right now because we don't seem to be respecting anyway. Right. The other person's opinion, but just arguing all the time. But do you think the pro-immigrant movement has been wrong in taking confrontational positions against these conservatives?
No. I think that, our work to engage the geographic and the political middle of the country is ineffective without a strong and powerful immigrant community or progressive base, if you will. Because, with no base, you have no middle. And I think it's very important for the immigrant community to make clear to the American public who they are, what their aspirations are, what their contributions are, and own their dream and take accountability for what they do. And I think we have to understand that, other Americans are going to react to that assertion in one way or another. And I think that as a movement within the immigration world, we have become more sophisticated in terms of understanding what's the role and the importance of a powerful immigrant rights community and what's the role and the importance of a strategy to engage middle America.
So let's go back to who you are. I know in the book you said you don't like to talk about yourself.
So let's talk about that, yes. But please, continue.
But you're probably used to it by now. So tell us about you. You were born in Santa Cruz. So you're Californian.
Yes.
Son of Pakistani immigrants. And you said that where you grew up, there were not that many people like you. So tell us a little bit about how you navigated that stuff.
So my parents came from Pakistan in 71. They ended up, they were both trained as physical therapists, and I was born in Santa Cruz. And both of my parents went through the journey to get the hours, to earn the hours to get a license, they realized that in Salinas, California, there was only one other physical therapist. So they moved to Salinas. My dad started a practice. My mom ran the business side of the office. And I grew up in a South Asian community at that point in Salinas of myself, my sisters, and my parents. But I have to say that I am so grateful for what my parents taught me. They taught me that it is important to be able to work across cultural lines. They taught me it is important to be, yes, South Asian or Pakistani, but it's also important to understand where others are coming from. And it's also important to, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And, my dad's office, that painting hung. And I remember walking into his office every day every summer and seeing that painting and that saying. And, those kinds of things stick with you.
So Salinas, that's an agricultural community, right? The salad bowl of the world, they call it, right? In Monterey County, Northern California. Mm-hmm. So there were the owners and then the workers, the Latinos and the white Americans that owned most of the farms, I would imagine. So, and then there was you.
Yep. Yeah, so most of my friends growing up were, children of farm owners or children of farm workers.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it at the time, but I began to understand, okay, what does it mean to get to know people and become friends with people who are different than me, the Mexican community. People still think I'm Mexican, I can smile and nod in many languages. Spanish is not one of them. But growing up in that community, growing up with my parents and the way they raised us, I think allowed me to understand, to just develop an appreciation for the world writ large.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say that a lot of my Mexican friends are told that they look Middle Eastern or Southeast Asian. So it's that goes to show that you can't really judge people by their color, right? And I'm Latina, and people don't believe that still. Right. Like, oh, you're too white. All right. So one of the groups that you talk to a lot is the faith community. Yep. And there's a lot of allies there in that fight. And just this week, an evangelical pastor from here, from a church of the Assemblies of God here in Echo Park, got arrested because he was undocumented. The Latino evangelical community is so large right now. It's grown so much. Mm-hmm. A lot of the community is undocumented, and a lot of the pastors themselves are undocumented as well. So you have a community where 8 out of 10 persons in the larger evangelical, in the white evangelical community, they're supporters of Mr. Trump. Mm-hmm. And then you have the Latino evangelical community, which is less supportive. So give us an idea of how you approach those communities and how you work with them.
Sure.
Because they seem pretty set on their ways, at least the white evangelicals.
Yep. So I think that for many, many years, we would always approach immigration as an economic policy question. We always thought, let's get the Chamber of Commerce, let's get the business community out there to talk about the value of immigrants. And I'm not saying that's not important, but over the years, I have come to believe that this is not a question solely about economics. And in fact, you know, a business leader in this moment in time is probably the least compelling messenger or advocate for this question. I think that the question of immigration is one that people see as a question about culture and values. So therefore, it's more of a social policy question. And I don't think that you can address social policy in our nation without understanding how the faith community engages. Mm-hmm. So in 2011, when we started to do this work, we started to embark on the strategy. We began to develop relationships with different evangelical organizations, ranging from the Southern Baptist Convention, the National Association of Evangelicals, to the National Hispanic Leadership Conference, to others. And what I realize is that, you know, this is a community, the evangelical community, is growing very quickly because of Latinos, even because of Asians. So there was a vested interest on their part because their congregations were shifting. On the other hand, there was a lack of understanding within evangelical leadership, even at the local level, of kind of how to have these conversations. So there was a particular book written by Matt Sorens and Jenny Yang, both with World Relief, called Welcoming the Stranger. And it's become kind of the, no pun intended, the Bible, within the evangelical community of how to engage in this question. Mm-hmm. They cite scripture, they provide prayer guides. And what we found working with Jenny and Matt and beginning to develop these relationships is that pastors were, you know, as they saw a Latino family in their congregation, that they'd go up to the family and ask the question, okay, what can I do to help? And the family would say, I need your help on immigration. You know, I'm undocumented, or I need to become a citizen. And the pastor would, you know, and by and large, a white congregation would suddenly be faced with the question of, okay, how do I deal with the question of legality?
Right.
So for them, they would, you know, they would return to their Bible and ask the question of, okay, how do I engage in this issue? And with Matt and Jenny and others within the evangelical community, we began to develop, on our part, an understanding and together a strategy of how do we engage evangelical America on this conversation. That wasn't about policy. It wasn't about politics. It wasn't even about legal status. It was really about the culture and values of the community and how through those values do they engage a changing community.
And yet it seems that, and in covering this issue of the pastor that was arrested this week, I got to the point where I talked to the leaders of all the Latino evangelical groups, and they're all appalled at what happened, right? And my question was, so how's the white evangelical groups, how are they responding? And I haven't been able to get an answer from them. But from some of the Latinos, I've heard that they're actually writing letters and talking to people in the administration, trying to intercede, not to keep deporting all these Christians, because supposedly, they're against, you know, religious persecution,
I think that there's a, and I'm not an expert on, you know, evangelicals in America, so I don't want to convey that. But it is clear there's a pretty strong debate happening within white evangelical America, evangelical America, not just around immigration, but really what's the relationship of the church to government. And my sense is that among younger evangelicals, they want a greater distance. They want to be able to go to church and say, this is what I believe, and politics is over there. Whereas there's an older generation that sees a closer relationship between the church and politics.
And that just does, like Catholics do. Catholics just,
right.
Keep their distance.
And that's playing out on immigration. And I think that a number of white evangelicals that we've worked with over the past 5 years, they're Trump supporters. Mm-hmm. Their congregations are Trump supporters. But now they are starting to ask the question of, okay, what is this administration going to do with regards to immigration? And questions are starting to come up.
But as you said in your book, the congregations seem to pay more attention to the media, their media,
yep,
that says what they believe, than their pastors.
And that's a challenge, I think, for institutions writ large, whether it's a church, a synagogue, a temple, or an education institution. One of the strategies that I wrote about was implemented by the Evangelical Immigration Table, where in 2013 and 14, as the immigration reform bill was being introduced and moving through the Senate, there was a radio campaign ran in South Carolina. And the radio campaign was a one-minute script read by, in this case, Reverend Jim Goodrow, Southern Baptist minister in South Carolina. And the script read, in essence, laid out the biblical principles behind the need for immigration reform. And the punchline was, now is the time to pray for our elected officials. Mm. And this was in response to an attack ad by some of the opposing organizations. The campaign over the course of the next 18 months was run across the country, again, with a very clear focus on this message, run on Christian radio stations in conservative districts. And an evaluator at the University of Pennsylvania found that white evangelicals who heard the ad, their opposition to immigration reform dropped up to 15 points. And it was not an ad, again, it was not an ad made the case based on policy or politics. Mm-hmm. It was an ad that made the case for immigration reform based on culture and values that, had the potential to echo what people were hearing in their church on Sunday. So to me, it was clear evidence that there is a way to reach social conservatives through culture that gets past the filter of Fox News and others.
That is a good thing. So many people on the anti-immigrant side believe that immigration is above all and only an issue of law enforcement. It's only an issue of whether you follow the law or not. They say, what part of illegal you don't understand, mm-hmm, et cetera. Then at the same time, many law enforcement leaders are split as well, because some of them don't see the point on being made to enforce immigration laws when they're supposed to be running after criminals who kill and rob, right, and do other things. And there are others who are actually, jumping on the bandwagon, yeah, of doing immigration. So what's your experience with, mm-hmm, with law enforcement and how you...
Sure. So in the book, I interviewed a handful of law enforcement officials. One, it was in California, Sheriff Margaret Mims of Fresno County. Mm. And then one of the others was Sheriff Mark Curran in Lake County, Illinois. So Sheriff Curran was interesting because when he came into office, he came into office as sheriff as kind of the Joe Arpaio sheriff, meaning that he wanted to take on immigration responsibilities. He wanted to detain and deport the undocumented community within Lake County, yeah, because he believed that that was a law and order sheriff. Mark Curran is also a devout Catholic, an Opus Dei Catholic. And he tells me that the reason that he shifted was when the Archbishop of Chicago pulled him aside and said, Sheriff, as a devout Catholic, I would like you to read these materials from the U.S. Catholic Conference. So Mark goes and reads these materials. He talks to some people kind of in the political world, and he realizes there's a different way that he needs to be doing his work. Mm. So the best part about his story is that he actually ended up going back to the first Republican kind of committee that endorsed him. I was just thrilled. And he went back and he said, I remain a Republican, I remain conservative, but I'm in favor of immigration reform. And I found the clip. And the clip, the news clip, and the lead was, to an unappreciative audience, Sheriff Curran lays out his change in immigration legislation. But it was his values. It was, yeah, his faith that led him to believe that he can be a law and order sheriff without targeting the undocumented.
Mm-hmm.
And then in Fresno County, Sheriff Mims, she's a devout Baptist, goes to church every Sunday, and she says that she believes that it's her role to do her job with the heart of a servant. You know, she was born and raised in the area. She's seen it change. She's seen the diversity of Fresno County change. And she says that now as she's, you know, patrolling her county and she sees the East, you know, the Asian immigrant community family working in their garden, she sees themselves. She sees herself and her own experience growing up, you know, picking crops. And what she told me, which I was surprised by, was that it's a big county. And she realized that as the diversity of the county grows, her forces, the diversity of her deputies needs to grow. So she was, you know, trying to recruit, you know, Punjabi sheriff deputies, Latino, Asian, because that's, you know, that's who they were running across. And you don't expect this in Fresno County, again, from a Republican sheriff.
Right, yeah, that's very interesting. At the same time, there's all this discussion about sanctuary cities. Mm-hmm. This is another term that's kind of dangerous because it means one thing for one group. It means another thing for another group. The idea that the president is throwing out is that sanctuary cities actually do not cooperate with immigration authorities, which is generally not true.
Right.
From what I understand in my work as a journalist, what they don't want is to be assisting ICE or holding people in jail, you know, if they're arrested, or actually doing immigration work for them. You know, they want people to have a certain trust in law enforcement. So why is law enforcement so important in this battle? And how do you get them to speak up more and talk about the law in another way?
Yep. I think that as over the last 3-4 years, and this is conflated with the refugee crisis in the Middle East, the Marathon bombing in Boston, and with other incidents across the country, the issue of national security and terrorism and public safety has really been inserted into the immigration debate in a really, really powerful way. And it undermines or inhibits the job that local law enforcement want to do or would like to do. And the way that I put it is that I don't want to live a sanctuary city. I want to live in a safe city. Because every cop in Los Angeles has taken an oath to serve and protect the entirety of their community. The only way for them to do that is to have the trust of the entirety of their community. And as soon as that cop on the corner is seen as enforcing immigration law, that trust is gone. So, you know, I have a frustration here because I feel that, you know, the word sanctuary is not a legal term, is being bandied about by both sides to their own devices. And in the middle is, I think, the majority of Americans who, they don't want to live in a sanctuary city. They want to live in a safe city. And, you know, they want to see a country that is in control of its borders. And there's nothing wrong with that. And I just think that we have to understand how others are hearing and reacting to the language that we use. And I think we can accomplish the same goals of public safety for everybody without, triggering a very emotional reaction.
Talking about words.
Yes.
I just wanted to ask you how you see the media environment today, because, you know, I fight with people a lot when they accuse media. Like, media is such a broad subject.
Yep.
It's such a broad term. There's journalism and there's media, right? Mm-hmm. And there's serious journalism and there's fake news, which in fact exists, but it's not what some people leads you to believe, in my opinion. So, how does media help or hurt the image of the immigrant community?
Mm-hmm. I think that I see this as there are multiple media spheres in the nation. There is, you've got your conservative media, you know, Fox, Breitbart, Drudge. You have your mainstream liberal media that I will, you know, kind of, with all due respect to the room, kind of it's the Hollywood scene. But then you also have a very large, faith-driven media. So you have, you know, Christian Broadcasting Network, Christianity Today, and others that can sometimes be conservative, but sometimes also fairly progressive on issues, or at least open-minded on issues. So for us, what we try to understand is, okay, what's the audience that we're trying to reach? What media do they pay attention to? And then what's, not just what's the message, but most importantly, who is the messenger that somebody will trust? Because each slice, each sphere has a set of trusted messengers. And if you live in one sphere, you just kind of look at the other sphere and say, I don't believe that person because I don't trust them. So I think what we have, what we try to do is, again, understand who our audience is, the message, but most importantly, the messenger.
And this reminded me of the ad that you guys ran during a Republican debate last year, the ad with Ronald Reagan talking about immigration. If you guys go to YouTube and you Google debate, I think it's 1980, Reagan, Bush, immigration, you will find the most amazing piece of video you've ever seen, how Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush talk about welcoming immigrants. Mm-hmm. You know, we want immigrants in this country. We don't want walls. I mean, it's just completely like the opposite of what we have today.
But the other, I mean, the ad that we ran was...
So was it effective?
That's a good, great question. So the ad, just to provide some context, was it was ran during the September 2015 Republican primary debate at the Reagan Library up the coast. And what we did is we took the clip of Reagan's farewell address in the Oval Office, the Shining City on a Hill speech. Right. And we put very powerful imagery. But then in the first 30 seconds and the second 30 seconds, we had clips from, at that point, Trump, Cruz, and Walker saying, you know, build the wall, deport them all, et cetera. A few weeks ago, just to kind of give a more contemporary example, we had there's a number of really bad pieces of legislation that moved through the Congress, and we're sitting in the office on Friday, and we're thinking, okay, what's the message that we can convey to a modern and conservative audience that taps their emotions? And we went back to that Reagan ad, and we had whittled it down to a 30-second spot that was just Reagan. And we took out all the clips from the candidates. It was just Reagan with that passage from Shining City on a Hill, where, you know, if a city has walls, it must have doors. And for all those who are strong and brave enough to be here. And we ran it on a Facebook campaign. And we found that through Facebook, we reached almost 500,000 people. We focused on conservative audiences.
And it's free.
And, we didn't spend, however...
We're cheap.
Yeah. But we found that it was a message that resonated with conservatives because it was speaking to their understanding of the world or their belief what the world should be and the language that Reagan used at that time. And the challenge for us is, you know, how do you take something that took place in, you know, the 80s and bridge it to, you know, present day United States?
Yeah, because there's, I mean, you mentioned the Breitbart and,
right.
and Fox, but there's something to the right of that. And,
yeah.
you know, the alt-right
yeah.
media
yeah.
and Ann Coulter and people like that, they flatly say that Ronald Reagan was wrong in supporting immigration reform in 1986, and they just go way beyond that. So one of the chapters that I like the most about the book is the one about Texas.
Yeah,
it's called The New Texas, and of course you talk about, you know, Houston and all these cities, Austin and all these parts of Texas where there's all this diversity. Of course, there's like a million undocumented people in Texas. There's so many. There's like 40% of the population is Mexican American, something like that. And yet, Texas as a political entity is still behaving as the old Texas, old West.
Right.
The governor, the attorney general, everyone, they're leading the charge against immigration. They're even to the right of Donald Trump right now on some issues like DACA, you know, protection for young people, young immigrants. So what will it take for Texas? It took about 20 years here in L.A., in California.
Yep.
To go from 187 to where we are right now. What's up with Texas?
Actually, the other chapter, there's a, what's up with Texas? Very good question. One of my favorite chapters is the chapter called Identity, Integration, Influence. Mm-hmm. And it's based on a number of interviews that I did here in California. And the basic theory that I put forward is that the immigrant community, over time, as people come to the U.S., their identity changes. So somebody comes from Mexico, they see themselves initially as Mexican, then Latino, then American, then go back to Latino. But there's a shifts in identity.
That's true.
They become American in one way or another. So their identity shifts. Then the community integrates into the U.S. They're learning, and it's not necessarily sequential, but as they integrate into the U.S., they're starting a business, they're learning the language, they are becoming citizens. Then there's an element of influencing the system, where now in California, the largest number of Latinos in a state legislature. You have this political power of the Latino community in influencing systems, whether it's the public sector or the private sector. So in California, in this chapter, I kind of trace it back to 187, not even to 187, but to 1986 and the Reagan Amnesty Bill.
Yeah.
And this path of identity, integration, influence of California's immigrant community. Texas, I think, is, it's somewhere in the kind of identity stage still. Mm-hmm. Because one thing about Texas that I found is that there are a large number of Latinos in Texas who, still identify very strongly with Mexico, even if they've been in the state for decades. But then on the other hand, even those individuals have integrated into the state. They're voting. They're business leaders, but there's something that is still standing in the way of the Latino community in Texas to go from identity integration to influence. Mm. And there's, it's a bigger state. It's a much more diffuse state. And it's a state that, the civic culture, it just isn't there yet.
There's also been a lot of efforts to disenfranchise Latino voters there.
And it's a very...
And redistricting.
Yeah. And I think that, frankly, the Anglo community in Texas has really held on to power. In a really, really quite vicious way sometimes.
And the governor is married to a Mexican woman, ironic thing. Okay.
So
So what's up with Texas?
So what's up with Texas? I think it's changing. I wrote about this city called Pasadena, suburb of Houston. It's 65% Latino. The median income is $30,000. It's a blue-collar working town in suburban Houston. 20 miles to the west is Sugar Land. Much more diverse, 30% Asian, 30% Latino, 30% Anglo. Median income of about $65,000. But in those 20 miles of space, a completely different political conversation. In Sugar Land, you have Democrats and Republicans across the immigrant community running for office. In Pasadena, you have Latinos scraping together resources to run for office and fight for political power against an entrenched interest who are redistricting them out of influence. It's a fight.
Mm-hmm. So we have a few more minutes to chat before we open it up for questions. So get ready to ask your questions. And I want to talk to you about something a little bit more personal. Mm-hmm. You are a Muslim, even though you're not religious, according mm-hmm. to what you say in your
yep.
book. In the book, you talk about your visceral reaction to some of the stuff that mm-hmm. Donald Trump has said and done. Mm-hmm. about Muslims, including the Muslim ban, which is now partially in effect. Tell us a little bit yep. about that.
So, writing the book was incredibly fun. Talking about the book has been tougher than I expected because it ended up being a much more personal project. And it really hit me. And my day job with the forum is, this is what I do as I talk. And it's easy because I've always been able to talk about the immigrant community, because I was born here. There's some distance, and I would always be able to say, this is what the immigrant community's benefits are, contributions are, aspirations. These are the opportunities, etc. So on December 7th, 2015, I land in Los Angeles from Mexico City, and on that day, on that morning, is when Trump announces his statement, releases a statement committing to ban Muslim immigration. So I see it go by, and something happens. I said, "Okay, well, I've just come back from Mexico City. I advocate for the undocumented immigrant community, and I'm culturally a Muslim. I'm like the Trump trifecta." but I also realized that I can't. I felt I was almost like triggered. I was gun shy in terms of saying something. So we didn't say anything. As an advocacy organization, that's kind of your thing. You always say something right. when something like this happens. So we didn't release a press statement. I kind of kept quiet for an entire day and a half. So over the course of that day, doing meetings here in LA, I'm watching my Twitter feed, and I sit down with Gregory Rodriguez, who runs the Zocalo group here, mm-hmm. and he kind of tells me, says, I feel like the Latino community is no longer like the boogeyman here. And I pause and I say, "You're welcome." So the next morning, I'm packing up and I'm staying at my sister's in town, and I see my passport on the bedside table. And then it hits me. It's like, this is personal. You know, this is about who I am, who my parents are, my community, just as it is about all Americans. So I remember I picked up my passport, I took a photo, and I put it up on my Facebook feed, and I wrote, I've never been more proud that my parents came from Pakistan and I have one of these. Hmm. And it was at that moment where I realized that it was different.
It is. So before we go to questions, let me add one more question here, because I'm interested in what you think about, you talk about a cultural reaction, mm-hmm. More than a policy issue. What do you make of Latinos and other minorities who support Trump, especially Mexicans?
Every conversation has a different question. there are a lot of people that we work with that support Donald Trump, that support him over the course of the campaign, that still support him, that are Latino, that are white, that come at it from a business, law enforcement, or faith perspective. I'm not going to say it's not difficult to kind of say, okay, why? You just kind of want to ask the question of why. Why? Right. But I have to believe that at the end of the day, the majority of Americans are people of goodwill, whether they're Latino, African-American, Asian, white, et cetera. And that I think that the majority of Americans, they want to live in a nation of laws that is controlled, and they want to live in a nation that is welcoming. And I think as an advocate, we have a tendency to believe that you're one or the other. And I think that the majority of Americans are always moving along that spectrum. And we have to develop the conversations, the strategies, the ways for people to live in that tension, operate in that tension, and feel the confidence so that they are weighing in with their elected officials, with their media, with the people who they influence to say, you know what? The Jose that I know, the Muhammad that I know, I love them. And they are just as the same as the Jose or the Muhammad that I don't know. Mm. And we've got a long way to get to that place.
Yeah.
But I know we're not going to get to that place if my assumption is that you supported Donald Trump, therefore I can't talk to you.
Right. It's like people hate Congress, but they love their congressman. I've never understood that.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay, so we're going to open it up for questions. Any burning issues people want to bring up?
Hi. Excuse me. Good evening. Do you think the immigration issue would be different if the face of the immigrant was a different face?
Yes, it would, and no, it won't. It would remove the sense of, I can't physically or culturally identify with this person. But I think then the question of the economic anxiety would still be there. That's why I've always believed that this issue is driven by both factors, race and class. The book, for example, was reviewed in the Washington Post. And, the reviewer said, more or less, well, why doesn't, the author just kind of call everybody a racist? And it's like, well, that's yes, it's part of the debate, and yes, it's certainly part of the anxiety, and maybe for some it really drives it. But I'm not sure that approach is going to solve the problem. But yeah, if, under the previous administration, when enforcement actions were prioritized, people who were not public safety threats were not put into deportation proceedings. A couple weeks ago, there was an Irish leader, a community leader out of Boston that mm-hmm. was detained and put into deportation proceedings.
He was deported.
He was deported. Mm-hmm. And you saw just an explosion in Boston media of, if he's not safe, nobody is safe.
If the white guy's not safe.
Yeah, well, I'm going to look at that as a teaching moment.
But, when you go back to the history of the United States, yeah. And that's fascinating yeah. to look back to the immigration history,
yeah.
you find that there was a reaction against the Germans,
yep.
there was a reaction against the Irish and the Italians,
mm-hmm.
there was a reaction, every single yep. wave of immigrant that came here, no matter what color they were, the ones that came before said, oh no, that guy that's coming after me, right, that's right. Not the good guy, right? Right. So it's not a new, right. It's not a new issue. Questions?
Hi, how are you doing?
Hey, Eric.
So my question for you is, like, I was formerly undocumented, right? And undocumented for a really long time. And people always ask me, like, why didn't you make yourself legal? Like, why did you wait all that time and not apply for citizenship, right? And I was actually going to ask a question along the lines of the previous question, which was, then people will say along the same lines, like, why don't you make yourself legal? And then the other question I get all the time is, like, or the comment is, my family did it the right way.
Right. Oh,
yeah. Why can you do it the right way?
Right.
But when you look at those policies from, like, the past, you can very quickly kind of go through, you know, well, the laws back then were very different than they are now.
Right.
And a lot of it did have to do with race, right? So how do you, when you're talking to evangelicals and law enforcement and business leaders, how do you explain why don't we make ourselves legal, mm-hmm. how the laws have changed? How do you start that conversation?
Yeah. So Doris Meisner, who, well, first of all, that's Julissa Ars. You should buy her book. It's a great, great, great story of her journey. So I think that the question, you know, so Doris Meisner, who ran Immigration and Naturalization Services for President Clinton, gave me a great quote in a conversation I had with her. And to paraphrase, she says, Americans cherish immigration in hindsight.
Yes.
Don't really love it in real time.
Yes, that's true.
So there's that kind of anxiety, right? You know, so my parents did it or my grandparents did it the right way. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that beautiful? You know, why can't you do it? So I think there's a deep misunderstanding of how the complexity and the injustice of the immigration system. There's no line for an undocumented person to get in. So in our strategy, if we're sitting down with, you know, faith leaders or law enforcement or business, particularly with the faith community, it's not a, you know, we don't start with, you know, this is the policy. We start with, okay, this is now who is in your community and or in your church. And, you know, there are incredibly courageous pastors who have, you know, gotten to understand how the demographics, how their congregations are becoming more diverse and develop strategies of, okay, how based on their religious beliefs do they begin a conversation of welcoming the stranger. But so then from that kind of cultural conversation, then you get to a policy conversation. We've just found that if we start with, you know, this is immigration policy and this is the history of it and these are the numbers and this is the process, you know, people are, there's always like a debate and there's, you know, you remove the humanity of it. And that's why I think that the role of the dreamers, the role of the immigrant community of telling their story is so incredibly powerful. Whether it's, you know, to Spanish language media, mainstream media, or even most, I would argue more importantly, to conservative media, because mm-hmm. that's the media that the Americans who are grappling with this question are will trust. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. So have you seen in your work any group of immigrants as they assimilate and try to live the American dream actually become conservative and then turn around and say, well, we did it this way? And I'm not talking about my grandparents. I mean, like, in the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
And then become conservative either politically, economically, culturally,
yep.
and then say, okay, and maybe they did vote for Trump and say, okay, we've got to do something about the borders. We've got to do something yep. about crime. And they, like, this is how they feel they should be now that mm-hmm. they've assimilated to the United States.
Yeah, so, I mean, there is no, you know, 100% of the immigrant community is not in favor of immigration reform. They're not in favor of, you know, legalization for the undocumented. I would argue that the overwhelming majority, but I'm not going to say everybody, 100%. But that's changing. And I first sensed this change in 2011-12, as we ran up to the Obama re-election, and it was kind of Obama-Romney. I remember when Romney said self-deport.
Mm-hmm.
And that triggered something among conservative Hispanics. Cubans, for example. Cubans said, okay, you can't deport me. You know, I'm a U.S. citizen. You know, I was good as long as the moment I got here. But what they saw was that whether it was self-deport or, you know, massive increases in immigration enforcement, was a lack of respect. So even for the culturally or politically conservative, Hispanic or Asian or Vietnamese, they still want to be respected. And I think that, frankly, the Republican Party, the more that they are disrespecting a fast-growing electorate, they're losing the opportunity to make the case on policy issues. And, you know, the way that, you know, Marco Rubio put it is that you can't convince somebody to vote for you when you're telling them that you're going to deport their grandmother, right? So I think that at our core, whether we're liberal or conservative, we want to be respected. And right now there are a lot of politicians out there who are disrespecting immigrants writ large.
Questions? Yep. Thank you both for your presentation. So what do you think comes first? What is the symbiotic relationship between the increasingly aggressive immigration enforcement practices, even disrespecting sensitive locations like churches, schools, and now courthouses where they do raids? Or do you think it's a product of populist groundswell against the immigrants? And why doesn't the population remember stuff like, you know, Nazi Germany or other really aggressive, you know, enforcement policies that led to, you know.
I think that the level of fear and anger in the country is at a height, and that's not, you know, that's not a hot take. You know, that's not breaking news. I mean, that's pretty obvious. The question is, I mean, but what's different now is you have, you know, frankly, a candidate and now a president who is willing to tap into that anger, and you know, instead of explaining to people that, you know, the changing economics of the world are not driven by immigration, but they're driven by automation. Yep. All right, they're driven by globalization. They're not driven by, you know, the immigrant living one, you know, a couple doors down. So I think what's happening is that the administration has tapped into this fear. They have redeployed resources within DHS so that, you know, immigration officers, they have the full latitude they've always wanted to be able to go to a church, be able to go to courthouses, to be able to go to households and, you know, say, okay, I'm looking for one person, but if I run across you and you're undocumented, you're out of luck. And what's happening is that, you know, in Houston, I know it came up in LA too, in Houston, they saw in the first quarter of 2017 a decrease in sexual assault reports within the Latino community by 30 or 40%, even though it was increasing across the general population. So that just means that, you know, people are not reporting crimes, which makes us all less safe. And I mean, the reason is because ICE, when they knock on a door, what do they say?
Police.
Police. So there's no differentiation for the immigrant community between what ICE is saying and what local police.
Well, they
are
know
doing.
If they say ICE, people are not going to open the
right.
door.
Next question, right here.
Hello, thank you both. It was a very interesting conversation that we've had. Well, first of all, the issue that comes about that immigrants take over the jobs of Americans, you know, we know that's not true because immigrants do the worst jobs, the ones that Americans don't want to do, okay? So my question is, what have you talked about specifically in terms of economic and jobs, you know, that this issue that immigrants don't really take the jobs that Americans do?
Well, first of all, I think that Americans will do any job. Americans are hardworking people, just like immigrants are. So I think that it's important that we dispel the notion that immigrants are that Americans don't want to do specific jobs. I also think that we need to acknowledge that in the very short term, there is a very, very, very small negative impact on local budgets and the low-wage worker because of immigration. That impact disappears within, you know, a generation, actually within less than 5 years. So that very quickly, you're flipping into a net positive. So I think if we're going to ask others to have an honest conversation, we have to have an honest conversation. I think that at the end of the day, we need to be making the case to the American worker and their family of the benefits of immigrants and immigration. So, for example, for every farm worker, there are up to 3 jobs that are created upstream and downstream from that farm worker, that typically those jobs are held by Americans. marketing, sales, transportation, et cetera. So you take the farm worker out of the equation, where 75% of farm workers in the United States are undocumented, you take a lot of American jobs out of the equation. And that is something that somebody can understand, right? I can sit here and say, you know, immigration reform will increase GDP over, you know, $1.5 trillion over 10 years. And,
you know, anybody, that mean, right? Right?
Anybody here going to have a stake in that, right? So I think we have to think about examples that resonate with somebody's personal lives. And across industries and across sectors, we can find those examples and we can tell those stories.
This is your realm or not, but a couple of months ago, my daughter's friend, who's Hispanic, was at a restaurant in Santa Paula, which is the community he lives in, with his child in near in Ventura County. And while they were eating in this restaurant, ICE came in and had everybody, whether they were, you know, the white customers were allowed to stay seated and eat their meal. Everybody else was lined up and asked for documentation. And this is just a couple months ago in Santa Paula.
Yeah.
And the children, my friend's son who's 9, and the children in the community are in terror. And they're locking doors, and they're afraid to go to school. Now they're afraid to go to the camps. And my question is, what do we tell the children? How do we... my background is child development and mental health. And they called me and said, what do we tell the children? I don't have a clue. But...
People are terrified. Terrified. And, you know, that story that you just told, I've heard permutations of it, you know, communities across the country, and we've seen press reports that describe very similar situations. I think that it's important that we are telling children that they are safe, and that if their parents don't make it home, which is what their fear is, that somebody was there to keep them safe. And that person is a relative, a friend, a neighbor, a pastor, an educator. I think like the safety of kids, the emotional or the physical safety of kids, of immigrant children, has never been on greater edge. And that's a very, very terrible place for us to be as a nation.
Yeah. Hi there. I'm a little emotional after hearing that. I also had a question about children. I have my 15-year-old with me here today, and I'm also of Pakistani background. I never really thought about it too much or my religious heritage till recently with the last name Hussein. All three of my children are constantly encountering questions about immigration, about terrorism, about being deported. We're citizens. And my daughter here had three separate adults engage in a very strong conversation about how they don't want to pay for Mexican rapists, how this. And these are people in my community, people that I care for, live with, work with. And I struggle to find, as us adults are debating politics and policy, the children are actually put in situations where they have to answer questions that I believe they shouldn't have to answer. Mm-hmm. And I'm struggling to find tools, positive tools. Mm-hmm. My youngest, who was 10, broke down sobbing in school because she thought her grandparents were going to be bombed. But I mean, these are mild issues compared to what this lady described. My friend's daughter was assaulted because she wears hijab. You know, the stories go on and on. But I think there's a real need for our youth to have some real tools to be able to answer some of the questions or respond in a way where they're not further in distress or further distresses them. Thank you.
I think it's the institutions within our communities are more important now than ever. And those institutions are our schools, our churches, our community organizations. Because I think that, you know, we all believe that, okay, Facebook is going to save the world, right? We could argue the other direction pretty easily. So I think we have to find, you know, the institutions that we're comfortable with, that we identify with, but then ask the leaders of those institutions to reach out. And when I was in Houston talking, I learned just a little bit about some of the interfaith work happening in Houston, where it was the Muslim community. It's, you know, has one of the largest South Asian communities in the country, the Jewish community, the Christian community, working together to build understanding across these institutions. And I just think that as much as our elected officials, some of our elected officials would like to tear down or dismiss the power of these institutions, I think it's up to us to re-energize and reinvigorate and ask those institutions to play a much, much larger role in our families' lives.
Well, I think we're done. Thank you so much
for coming and joining us. Thank you.
Thank you, Ali.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.